Philo Torah Zoom Shiur for the 16th day of Sivan, 5786, corresponding to June 1st. I neglected to say it's Yom Sheni, which is another name for Monday. And that's about it. So we proceed to Tehillim. There we go. Tehillim Kuf, Mizmor Latoda, Hariu Ladonai Kol Haaretz, Ivdu et Adonai Besimcha, Ba'u Lufanav Bir Nana, De'u Ki Adonai Hu Elohim, Hu Asanu V'lo Anachnu, Amo V'Tzon Marito, Ba'u Sh'arav Betoda, Chatzerotav Betehillah, Hodu lo baruch hu shemo, ki tov Adonai le'olam chasdo, v'ador v'ador emunato. Mark. Kaf.
When I say after his brother David, Yan Chadun of Yom Sarai is a gift for Hashem Elohe Yaakov. He slaps Ezra Chami Kodesh, which Yoni Zadeka, his core coming Hosea of Yola Safaya Dasha Nesela, eating the Fossil of Vessel of Colossus Safaya Malay, and Rana Navi to Asecha, of Shem Elohenu needs gold, Yamalay Adonai, Komich Alo Secha, Akayadati, Ki Hoshia Adonai Mishiko, Yanio Mishame Kacho, be gross Yesha, Yamino, Eleva Recha, Eleva Hosum, Vanaku, Bishem Adonai, Elohenu Nazgir, Ima kara uvena falo vanach nu kamnu vanis odad Adonai Hoshia hamelashi arninu viyom koreinu.
Kuf Aleph, Shir Lama'alot the Sinai El Heharim, May Ayin Yavo Ezri, Ezri Meim Adonai, Osei, Shamayim Va'aretz, Al Yitain Lamot Raglecha, Al Yanum, Shomerecha, Hine, Lo Yanum Veloyishan, Shomer Yisrael, Adonai Shomerecha, Adonai Tzilecha, Al Yad Yaminecha, Yomam Hashemesh Lo Yakeka, V'Yoreach Balayla, Adonai yishmorcha mikol ra'a, yishmor et nafshecha, Adonai yishmor et tzeitecha uvo'echa, me'ata v'yad olam. Mark.
Me to be Rafa Bosino, Abraham is Hashiako, we will refer to a lake of Ahaganali Israel, Vesan Shekopu Tabitahon, Almedim, Amishmar, Arsenu, Ariel Hino, Valo, Hamim Badeno, Min Halabanon, Adubami, Trimun, Hayam Hagado, Adlovo, Haravar, Homakom Shahim, Bayabashaba, Aviro Bayam, Contain Adonai Esarivino, Akamimalino, Nigasim, Nahem, Akados Baruchu, Ipmor, Viatilas, Hayalenu, Mikol Sarovitsuka, Mikol Negamakala, Vishlak Rahaba Hatsahabahama, Athea Dehem. Yadver, so ne enu tafehem, the Atarim Bethesda, Yeshua, Vateresi Tahon, the Puyam Bahem Hakasuv, he Adonai Elohim, Haolech, Imachem, Lahilachem, Lahem, Imoyabechem, Lahoshiashem, Benomar, Amen.
Amen. Together, Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael, Hanatunim Batzara Uvashivya, Haomedim Bein Bayam, Bein Bayabasha Uvein Baavir, Hamakom Yerachem Aleihem VeYotziem Mitzara LeYirvacha UMeAfela LeOra UMiShibud LeGeula Hashta BaAgala UVeZman Kariv VeNomar Amen. I'd like to dedicate the shiur in memory of my Bubby, my grandmother on my mother's side. This is her 90th Yahrzeit. She died 1936 when my mother was only 11 years old. So none of the children, grandchildren really knew her. And except that the name Miriam Bat Yosef Halevi, Miriam, we got about six or seven, maybe eight Miriams in the family. And if I have to boil it down, it's my two grandmothers more than my grandfathers who were responsible for who my father and my mother are, who are both responsible for who I am and my brothers and our children and grandchildren and even great-grandchildren. My youngest brother had his first great-grandchild, a girl, today, this morning, on my grandmother's Yahrzeit. So I'm taking bets that the name might be Miriam, but maybe not because there are already Miriams in that family. So we'll see what happens. but she her neshama should have an aliyah. But just to quickly, just on a personal note, 1910, my Zadie left Mizrich, Poland, came to the United States, or as we say now, went to the United States, and worked to earn enough to bring his wife, my Bubby Miriam, and their three children at the time, two uncles and an aunt of mine. And in 1920, 21, they came over. I checked on Ellis Island records and I saw the boats, the ships that they each came on, and their Polish names, which were similar to the Hebrew but Polishized. And then when the family was reunited, there were two more children, an uncle and my mother. My mother was the baby in the family. So there was a big split in 12 years or so between my mother and her sister, or 13 years. And that zigzag, half generation, continues ad hayom hazeh. But that's the story. Last night we had a wedding in the family of her, one of her great grandchildren, and also on her yahrzeit, although the chuppah was before Shkia, actually was supposed to be before Shkia, but we won't count minutes. My brother said, should we ask the Masada Kedushin if he changed the text in the ketuvah? That's a touchy subject because it has to reflect the accurate date. Anyway, that's my story. We're reading Parshat Shlach in Chutz Laretz. They're reading Parshat Be'alotcha this week. And I think it's only fair to report that my column in the Jewish press was about Be'alotcha. And therefore, I don't feel guilty about making this particular Zoom shiur mostly about Shlach. But we need to see it in the background, with the background of Be'alotcha. I don't know if you were struck with the contrast between the beginning of the Sedra and the end of the Sedra, the first half, Be'erech, and the second half of Be'alotcha. But it's a very hard thing emotionally to see the beginning of Be'alotcha with Aharon lighting the menorah, tending the menorah in the morning, lighting it in the evening, with the Levium being sanctified, with the description of the travels of soon to take place of Bnei Israel, with the first annual Korban Pesach and the Pesach Sheni episode, and the silver trumpets which were to be used to assemble the people or to signal their travels. Good, 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 nice stuff. And it's not just the beginning of Be'alotcha, but it comes from Naso also. And that came from Bamidbar since the beginning of the book of Bamidbar. And I guess if you want to take a good full picture, back in Vayakel Pekudei, when the book of Shemot finished with Melechet HaMishkan, the whole book of Vayikra is not really connected to things that happened. It's just a lot of mitzvot, 247 of them, and a lot of korbanot and tuma and tahara and all kind of stuff. And it really was the story being put on hold with truma, with Vayakel and Pekudei in the end of the book of Shemot. And it's if God said, okay, pause, hear all of Vayikra, and then takes it off of pause back in Bamidbar to put the storyline back in. So from the beginning of Bamidbar, good stuff, good stuff, good stuff, into Naso, through Naso, Birchat Kohanim, the dedication of the Mizbeach, and the beginning of Be'alotcha, which I just described to you. And then there is a very abrupt break, which I mentioned last week is signaled by two psukim, making up one parsha, with a scribal minhag of writing the letter nun in the blank space that leads up to this parsha, a backwards nun, and then Vayhi ben Nesoah Aharon and Uvnocho Yomar, two psukim which we're very familiar with, when we open up the Aron to take out the Torah, and when we put the Torahs back and close the Aron, and then another backwards nun, making that two pasuk parsha the most isolated and loneliest parsha in the Torah, to which all of our sources say it basically divided the book of Bamidbar into two separate books, and it itself, even though it's only two psukim in one parsha, is like its own book, because the very, very next topic in Balotcha is the people complaining. And the first complaint, as I mentioned last week, we don't even know what they were complaining about, but the Torah says that the complaint started with the Asafsuf, the Egyptians that were smart enough to leave Mitzrayim together with the Jews, and they've been hanging around for a year, pretty much exactly a year, a little bit more, and they got fed up and they complained. But then the Torah tells us that regular B'nai Israel were also crying, and we don't see in those opening psukim of the second half of Baalotcha, which is really the second half of the whole book of Bamidbar, we don't see why they were complaining. We just know that God got angry and there was a retaliation, so to speak. And maybe it was the same complaint, or the next complaint was for food, specifically for meat, which they said, "We're disgusted with this mun all the time, mun, mun, mun." And then all of us would think, how could you be disgusted with mun if it's supposed to be able to taste like anything you want? So you can't get bored of it, you know. I think I'll have pizza today. So the mun miraculously tasted like pizza. And then when you say to your mother, I wanted pizza flavor with onions and mushrooms, so the mun miraculously for you changed into that. I don't know how that works, but we're talking miracles. But they complained. Now, I also last week contrasted their first complaint back in Parshat Beshalach, where they got mun first after complaining they were hungry, and the language is bitter. I must say this, which I forget to say all the time. We cannot judge that generation. We don't know what it is to have a 210-year history of being enslaved in Egypt, or at least restricted and isolated in Egypt. We don't know anything about Dor HaMidbar's mentality, but the Torah tells us certain things. And when the Torah tells us, it's got to be talking to us now, in our time, as it is in every generation since. So you have to say, okay, I'm not judging Dor HaMidbar, which, by the way, the Mishnah does, because the Mishnah in Sanhedrin says, Dor HaMidbar, Ein Lahem Chelek Lolam Haba. Very powerful statement that they have no share in the world to come. We can't judge them. We need to judge ourselves. That's why coming up to Parshat Shlach, where the theme is a rejection of Aliyah in essence, and I took it and have always taken it as a challenge, the fact that the very first issue of Torah Tidbits was in 1992, June, Parshat Shlach, as if it said this is going to be a recurring theme, not just once a year, but often, to the point where people who didn't like what I had to say about Aliyah would write to me saying, "Can't you talk about something else? Why don't you talk about Shabbos and Kashrut? I'm comfortable with that. I said, that's why I talk about Aliyah, because you're not comfortable with that. I don't need to talk to people who are Shomer Shabbos and Kashrut about Shom, which I do anyway, but that's not the point. The point is, I have fond memories of my father every time we got up to Shlach, saying, and this already when we were thinking of our future in Eretz Yisrael, my parents, as well as my brothers and me, he says, I don't know how any Jew who is not projecting his future at some point in his life in Eretz Yisrael can listen to Parshat Shlach and not tremble, because the sin of the spies is alive and well today. So you don't have to just criticize the 10 Meraglim for what they said, but you can, I believe, comment on, I was going to say criticize, I won't, you can comment on the Jews who say, what do we need to go on Aliyah for? We have everything we need for a full Jewish life here in fill in the blank. And I also, as you know, because I mention it often, distinguish between someone who is not here yet, I always try to say it like that, for reasons of family, could be parents he has to take care of, could be siblings and or grandchildren that he doesn't want to separate from, parnasa. I mean, those are two things. Family, at the Israel Center way back, we used to call it GDF, geographically divided families. And we had plenty of parents who left their children in the States, children who left their parents in the States, people who came on Aliyah and a sister wouldn't forgive them because the burden of taking care of a mother was now on her instead of shared by a brother, and so on, to the point where we actually had counseling kind of sessions. We didn't really call it that, but that's what it was, where they did psychodrama and acted out what it's like to be here without your parents or without your children, and how you feel about that. And this was before Zoom and before, was that other one, Skype, or before people used it a lot. And when I first came on Aliyah, there were aerograms, which we wrote, once a week or once a month or what less often, and so on. So that's, to me, the Shlach thing. Not, see, I can complain about the Mit-Onanim that wanted meat and said, why did you take us away from Egypt where food was free and we had watermelons or melons and leeks and garlic and onions and was the first one, kishuim, whatever the Torah's term referred to, and all we have here is the man. So that to me is a once upon a time, a long time ago. Although if you think about it, you need to update it in your mind and say, that's really the same thing when a person says whatever. But with the Meraglim, it was easy. It was easy. When I told, I said this also many times, when I told a very high-ranking official of the religious Zionists of America that I was coming on Aliyah, his answer to me was, what are you, crazy? And that said to me a lot. And then subsequently, I read in a Sochnut-produced volume of essays in honor of Israel's 40th. We just celebrated 78, so you know how long ago it was, if you could do the math. 40th anniversary, where there was a beautiful article of a rabbi who directed his words to the rabbis in the United States who defend themselves for staying for so long because of the wonderful communities that they've developed, and they all have a similar story. When I first came to this community, there were three Shomer Shabbos families, and now there are 200, and we didn't have a mikveh, and now we have a mikveh, and we have an Eruv, and we have shuls that people go to and shuls that people don't go to, and all of that, and a school, and this and that. Very fine. I'm not knocking that. But this rabbi was writing to remind, or more strongly to say to the American rabbis, give yourself a realistic amount of time, train somebody as an associate rabbi to take your place so that you won't feel like you're abandoning your community, and do what you're supposed to do, not only Kaman Aliyah, but say to the people of your community, let's go. So when I read that article, I was very impressed until I realized who wrote it, an American rabbi who served the rabbinate for many, many years and retired to Florida. So anyway, I was going to say, I don't mean to get on a soapbox, but I think I do. So that's Chizuk and Idud. In any event, what happened after the complaints at Kivrot HaTa'ava and the unnumbered deaths that occurred as a result of eating the quail until it was coming out of their nose, or however the Torah describes it, and then it just deteriorated from there, because the next immediate episode, which is part of that one, is Moshe Rabbeinu. No less than Moshe Rabbeinu complaining to God that he can't handle these people on his own. And his language. Now, if I'm not judging Dor HaMidbar, I'm certainly not judging Moshe Rabbeinu, but I'm sharing with you what the Psukim say. He says to God, if you can't help me in this situation, if I have found favor in your eyes, kill me rather than let me continue this way. And God's answer was, collect 70 elders, bring them to Ohel Moed, and some of Moshe's prophetic spirit was not transferred, but shared with them. And we don't know what happened from that. But then the next portion is Miriam and Aharon talking about Moshe Rabbeinu. And they didn't lie, they didn't even exaggerate. They just said Moshe imposed celibacy on himself. This is the sources that we have, that he separated himself after Matan Torah at Har Sinai from Tzipora and felt that he needed to be ready for prophecy 24/7, which he wouldn't be able to do if he continued a normal married relationship. And Miriam and Aharon, or Miriam complained to Aharon that we are also Nevi'im, we also have Nevuah, but we haven't separated from our spouses, and that. And Hashem got angry at them, and Miriam became a Metzora, and I don't know why Aharon was not equally punished, although Mefarshim tried to explain that, but that's not for now. That's last week's Seder, except for some of you. And that's how the Sedra ends. So Shlach begins as things are going worse and worser, as my daughters used to say when they were first learning to speak English. And I never understood why worser isn't a good idea, you know, but it's not a word. And Shlach Lecha Anashim. Now it comes with the words Vayedaber Hashem El Moshe Lemor, Shlach Lecha Anashim. Sounds like God is commanding Moshe to send the people to scout out the land. Rashi immediately says, Shlach Lecha, your choice, Moshe. I would rather, doesn't say that in those words, I would rather you take it on faith and just go into Eretz Yisrael. But if you, Moshe, feel that the best thing to do now for the people is to send scouts in advance, it's your choice. And it was a disaster. And you need not only Parshat Shlach, but you need to go to Parshat Devarim, when Moshe is telling the story about the Meraglim to the people of this next generation, because there are details there that are not in the original account in Parshat Shlach. For example, what do you mean Shlach Lecha? Why would Moshe want to send them? Because the people had come as a delegation to Moshe and to say to him, Nishlecha Anashim Lefaneinu, let's send an advance scouting party. So it came from the people. Moshe agreed to it. He tried to form it into something that could be presented when they came back as positive, and that failed dismally. When Kalev says what he said about Alona Ale, let's go, because we can do it, the other Meraglim said, well, the way the Torah calls it, they open their mouths with Diba Ra'ah Al Ha'aretz, and scared the people and panicked the people into not wanting to go. And it got worse, because then people said, okay, we were wrong, let's go. And Moshe said, no, it's not the time now, because the time was before the Meraglim was sent. But once you panicked at the Meraglim, then God is not going to be with you and you can't go. But they went anyway. And on and on. And this is not even till next week's Seder of Korach, which is a whole other story. It just goes down, down, down. And what I started to say is this has to depress us in a constructive way, if that makes any sense, to say, okay, this is what they did, and they couldn't undo that, but we can. We can be in the same situation and undo it. It's sort of, go back to Matan Torah, the summary of what Bnei Israel said that earned them a special place in God's eyes was Kol Asher Diber Hashem Na'aseh V'Nishma. We'll do it. Two words, Na'aseh V'Nishma. Kolev gave the other two words, Alo Na'ale, let's go up to Eretz Yisrael. And they wanted to stone him. And when the other Meraglim, the 10 of them, spoke, Kalev and Yehoshua and Moshe and Aaron tore their garments in Avelut, in mourning. Very, very hard. Very hard. But let me point out a couple of things, small things. This one, okay. The Parsha, Shlach Lecha Nashim, continues very soon thereafter with one leader from each tribe will make up this scouting party. Ve'ele Shemotam, and these are their names. Now, one thing I have not done thoroughly, which I'd like to, is every time the 10, not the 10, the 12 tribes are mentioned, or any, the sons of Yaakov, then the 12 tribes, I want to list the order in which they're presented. In the census in Bamidbar, because it was going to be based on the camps of three Shvatim each, instead of Reuven and then Shimon, like you would expect, it starts with Yehuda, and then Yisachar and Zevulun, and then Reuven and Shimon, and then Gad gets in there in different order, not by birth and not by mothers. And here, the order of the spies is different also, and here's one that the Mefarshim mention. It starts out with Mate Reuven Shamua ben Zakur. That was the spy from Reuven Shamua. Lamate Shimon Shafat ben Chori. Lamate Yehuda Kolev ben Yefune, one of the two that ended up okay. Lamate Yisachar Yigal ben Yosef. Lamate Ephraim Hoshea bin Nun. Hoshea, who later his name is changed to Yehoshua, is the scout or spy from Ephraim. The Torah almost always has Ephraim and Manasseh, or Manasseh and Ephraim, one after the other. Sometimes Ephraim first, sometimes Manasseh first. Here, they're separated. You have Lamate Ephraim, Hoshea bin Nun, Lamate Binyamin, Palti ben Rafu, Lamate Zivulun, Gadiel ben Sodi, and then Lamate Yosef, Lamate Menasher, Gadi ben Susi. So Mefarshim ask, how come? Two things. How come Ephraim and Menasher are separated in the list of the spies? And how come Yosef is mentioned together with Menasher, but not with Ephraim? And the answer is that the 10 spies, including the one from Menashe, would be guilty of motzi diba ra'a al ha'aretz, speaking basically lashon hara on the land of Israel. And Yosef, the Torah testified, was motzi diba ra'a al echav. He spoke to Yaakov stories in lashon hara about his brothers. So the link between the Menashe spy and Livnei Yosef is to put those two together under the topic of Dibara'a. And Ephraim, Hoshea bin Nun, is separated from them. It's not a perfectly satisfying thing because you have, why is Ephraim and Kolev mixed in with others? Why do you start with Reuven and Shimon? But that's another thing. What I found interesting is what happens, what you read right before Lamate Ephraim Hoshea bin Nun. The one right before is Lamate Yisachar Yigal ben Yosef. So that's not the Yosef. It's a different Yosef. But the fact is that as much as the Torah separated Ephraim from the association of Menasseh and Yosef, the Torah actually put the word Yosef right before the word Ephraim, even though it was a different Yosef. So I thought that was an interesting thing to point out. The other famous question is, why did Moshe bless Yehoshua by calling him Yehoshua and adding a yud to his name, Hoshea, if it was that he should come back with a favorable report? Then why didn't he give a blessing to all the Shvatim, all of the leaders? And especially the fact that it didn't include Kalev. For Kalev and Yehoshua were the two who came back with positive messages. Why just Yehoshua? And the Mefarshim explain that because of something that we're told at the towards the end of Bahalotcha, that two of the people who received Nevuah abilities after Moshe complained that he didn't want to do things alone were Eldad and Medad, and they prophesied. Torah doesn't in writing tell us what they said, but the Midrashim do. And that they prophesied that Moshe would die and Yehoshua would lead the people into Eretz Yisrael. And Moshe was afraid that Yehoshua would purposely not be enthusiastic about going into Eretz Yisrael and convey a negative message, not because of the motives of the Nasiim, of the other Shvatim's scouts, but because he wanted to protect Moshe. Like he knew that as long as they were in the Midbar, Moshe would remain alive, and he didn't want to see that Moshe would die and he would take over. So, Ke'ilu Moshe gave him a bracha that he should come back and say the good things, even if it costs Moshe his passing later. One other thing that you can point out, and that is,
When was that Nevuah? Was it after the Meraglim or before the Meraglim?
all right, so here we have a problem. The problem is exactly what you're asking. When exactly did this happen? I think it's more important to understand where the Torah tells us about it. And it tells us about it before the Meraglim went and came back with their negative report. So it's kind of, I don't know what the term is, not anachronistic maybe or whatever. It's not the proper sequence of time to say that Moshe anticipated that Yehoshua might be like the others. I mean, why would he send scouts if he anticipated that they would come back with a negative report and then have to give Yehoshua a blessing that he shouldn't be part of that? So maybe you could suggest it didn't happen exactly then, it happened later. I don't know about that. Here's where the Torah tells us what it's telling us is, let's call it prophetic rather than actual. And I'll tell you the first place that I really felt that, back in the description of the Mun. Bnei Israel had come out of Mitzrayim, gone through Yam Suf, had been attacked by Amalek, complained about water and it was sweetened, complained about food and they got the mun. And in the
Sarah,
description of the mun,
is
it
that Pesach
says they
Dvash?
ate the mun for 40 years in the Midbar. And then you say, wait a minute, how did the Torah know that? I mean, that's a silly way to ask the question. Because at that point, there was no Chet HaMeraglim. There was no Matan Torah yet, and there wasn't Nishlacha Anashim Lefaneinu. So that whole thing never happened when the Torah
Foreshadowing.
already tells us. No, because the Torah wasn't presented to Bnei Israel in its full text until the end of the 40 years, and what happened here? Sivia, you're trying to do something there?
I'm so sorry, that was an accident.
Okay. Don't let it happen more than two more times.
So sorry. I was just going to ask in the chat if everyone who isn't Phil could mute themselves. That was what I was trying to do. Failed miserably.
Okay. Anyway, so what I'm saying is the Torah is a lot of it is after the fact, and there are many more questions than the one that I just raised about the mun being eaten for 40 years, when who knew about that yet? Because they weren't told that. Moshe didn't lean that parsha to them. I don't even know if he knew it at that point, because he was taught the mitzvot of the Torah. I don't think he was told the stories that were still yet to come. Otherwise, that would raise a lot of other questions. So when you're writing it, when God is writing it, there's a purpose to it. His purpose obviously was to tell us that the mun was a miraculous food that would be accompanying them throughout their journey in the Midbar. And somehow you could sort of smile and say, oh, God just spoiled the story by telling us, here I am reading Parshat Beshalach, and Parshat Shlach is not for a long time. And yet he's telling us about 40 years in the Midbar, which is not going to happen for, 20 weeks. And that's not the way it works. Now, here's another thing. The guys that were Tameh for Korban Pesach, how did they become Tahor for Pesach Sheni? With Efer Porah Aduma.
Yeah, man.
Where does the Torah tell us about that? In Parshat Chukat. So if you take everything in the Torah as presented when we read it in the Torah, then there would be no way for them to become Tahor from Tumat Mate, but Parah Aduma had to be there before Ma'amad Har Sinai. They had to have gone through the whole thing with Parah Aduma at a much earlier point, because you can't build the Mishkan and you can't do anything if you're Tameh and you can't get rid of Tumah. So you could argue, you can say, okay, before Parah Aduma, mikveh was enough, or immersion in a pool or a stream or whatever. I don't know, different kind of answers. But this is always going to be a problem because you're reading the Torah, which was written for all generations, not a history and a diary and a journal for the stories that we see in the Torah. Every single, I often use as an example, Avraham was 30, was 86 years old when Yishmael was born. The next pasuk says Avraham was 99 years old and God appeared to him and said, circumcise all the males in your household and yourself, whatever. So then immediately, you're talking about two consecutive psukim, one that says he was 86, one that says he's 99. Hey, what happened on his 90th birthday? I don't know. He got up in the morning, he ate breakfast, probably sat by his tent and welcomed people. Nothing happened that God had to tell us about. And this is the way it is throughout the Torah. Coming up to Parshat Balak in a couple of weeks, the whole story with Balak and Bilam, we did not witness. We only know about it because the Torah says it. The Torah, God chose via the Torah to tell us the story of Bilam and Balak, the people who were saved from that threat of Bilam and Balak. Had no idea that they were under threat. And I don't know when they found out, probably just the day Moshe died, or when Yehoshua took them into Eretz Canaan and they started learning the Torah from the
Matovo
Torah.
Yaakov.
All of that was not known to them, but it's known to us.
Right.
And that's an important thing to keep in mind. Anyway, the one thing I wanted to, the other thing I wanted to point out in the Meraglim story is when it says, Alu Zeb, no, one second. Vaya'alu Banegev, they, the spies, went into the Negev. Vayavo, singular, Ad Chevron. So Rashi says that Kalev made a side departure from his assigned path, and he went to Ma'orat HaMachpelah to daven there, and that's what kept him on the straight and narrow when they came back. I have another thing which is interesting. Look at this. Vayavo'u ad Nachal Eshkol. They arrived at the Wadi of Eshkol, Vayechvetu Misham Zmorah, they cut from there a branch with a cluster of grapes, and the picture in the background struck me very nice. I went on to the internet. First, I went on to my files on my computer and saw how I depicted Parshat Shlach in the last 4, 5 years since I started Philo Torah. And then I went onto the internet and I looked for another way of doing it. And this one struck me because there's a medrash that says that the grapes were unusually large, which seems to be the case, bigger than pomelos, probably, looking at the comparison to their heads. How the two of them carried it by themselves, I have no idea, because there was another picture which had all 12 spies schlepping back the cluster of grapes. Anyway, that's the picture. But listen to the language here. They came to Nachal Eshkol, and they cut from there an Eshkol Anavim, a cluster of grapes, and also pomegranates and figs. Then it says, Lamakom hahu kara Nachal Eshkol. Alodot ha-Eshkol asher kartu misham b'nei Yisrael. They named the place that they cut the cluster of grapes from Nachal Eshkol, because that's where they cut the grapes from. Yet the pasuk right before says they arrived at Nachal Eshkol. So the logical way of understanding it is that was became the name, and the Torah was using the name that it was to become, rather than a name that we wouldn't be able to identify. But the Vilna Gaon has a chap. He says, take a look. Vayavo ad Nachal Eshkol, spelled Aleph Shin Kaf Lamed, no Vav. But when they cut the Eshkol, Kaf Vav Lamed, and they carried it, and they called the name of the place Eshkol with a Vav, because of the Eshkol with a Vav that they cut from there. So he says, like, it might have had a name, but the name took on more meaning when it was the place that they got the cluster of grapes from. So here's my personal story with that. I lived in Ramat Eshkol 35 years. There's a wadi right behind Ramat Eshkol. And I was walking in the wadi and I came across one of the burial caves from the second Beit HaMikdash time. The entrance was blocked. You could just see it from the outside. But the outside of this cave was decorated in stone with clusters of grapes. So I said, hey, the neighborhood is called Ramat Eshkol after Levi Eshkol. And Sderot Eshkol is the street named after Levi Eshkol. And here is a much older name to attach because there's a cave from the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, which would give the name Nachal Eshkol to this wadi before Levi Eshkol was even born. So I told this to somebody. I thought it was terrific. It really worked well. Told it to somebody. He said, you know, how many of those caves are around the country? They're all over the place. So, okay, there it went. But it was still a very nice connection that I made to this. Okay, so they come back after 40 days and they show the fruit and they said it's truly a beautiful land. However, too hard for us to take it over because the people there are giants, the cities are fortified, and we would never be able to handle it. That's when Kol.
Eretz Ocheles Yeshvaha.
No, not yet. That's the second part. The first time it was a good description, an encouraging description, immediately followed by, let's call it practicality. Not necessarily yet negative, because the term dibara'ah is not used until the second time they spoke. After they spoke this first time, Kalev takes the microphone and says, it's a good land, and alo na'aleh, let's go there like we're supposed to, because we'll be able to. To which the 10 spies took the microphone back, pushed Kalev out of the way, I picture in my mind, and said worse things. And that's when they said it's a land that eats up its inhabitants because they saw a lot of dead bodies, and it has
Funerals.
Anakim, and it has Bnei Anakim, which is like Hagrid. But if you think of Hagrid as a son of a giant, it loses the scare tactic. But anyway, how many know what I'm talking about? How many don't know what I'm talking about? Shame on you. Never read Harry Potter?
Nope.
David, I thought you were an intelligent guy. A witted guy. A good guy. Hey. Digression. I got
Is it in, is it in book, is it in the book Beyond number three?
No, yes, it's in number one. Hagrid was the
See, my
care.
grandfather only allowed to read to number three. Apparently, four, five, and six get a bit risque or something.
Risque, they got darker, but anyway, that's not the point. The point is, a woman living someplace in, I don't know, it doesn't matter where, someplace in Israel, called me or wrote to me that she objected to my speaking of Harry Potter in a positive way because it contains Isurim from the Torah of Kishuf and all of that, and we shouldn't let our children read it. So I invited her for a debate. And we had a packed house. What made it easy for me, who I was taking the positive side, was that the audience was like 99% on my side. And she was opposing the reading of Harry Potter. Our MC, or whatever you call it, the moderator for the debate, was Yaffa Ganz from Savta and Savta, or whatever her book is. And it was a wonderful evening. I tried to have pumpkin juice, but I couldn't find pumpkins in the shuk at the time. But I did serve jelly beans, which is another theme in that first book. And I won. I mean, it was not even a good victory because I said, give me a break. You know, jelly beans that taste like earwax is not the kishuf that the Torah is condemning. I said, kids are reading it and they're learning how to read with an enthusiasm that had never been experienced until the Harry Potter series. Anyway, so that's Hagrid. And then they said, Amalek lives in here, and that was meant as a scare tactic. And we looked like grasshoppers in their eyes, and that's how they thought of us also, which has its own lesson. You think of yourself as a grasshopper opposite your enemy, you're going to lose. And if you say that your enemy considers you as grasshoppers, that's worse, or both are bad. What you have to do when you fight against somebody is think in terms of equal, but more justified on your side. If you think that you're inferior to them, it'll affect the way you fight. If you think you're superior to them, it'll affect the way you fight. So that was one of the problems. And then that's when the Torah, after this whole panicky thing, refers to them as Motzi Dibara'a al Ha'aretz. The 10 of them were struck dead immediately. And the people panicked and said, you're going to turn our wives and children into widows and orphans. And why did you take us out of Mitzrayim? And they, the people, wanted to select leaders to bring him back to Egypt. And hold on one second. Giving a shear now. Bye. And the people wanted to go back to Mitzrayim. And the Meraglim themselves didn't want to go back to Mitzrayim. They wanted to remain in the Midbar where they were leaders. And they said, we have everything we need. And here's that voice again. We have everything we need for a full Torah life here in the Midbar. And that was hard to argue about because they had the supreme teacher of Torah, Moshe Rabbeinu, and they had food taken care of and water taken care of and protection taken care of and clothing taken care of and shoes taken care of. So all they had was a Torah way of life. And they said, this is great. We're going to go into Eretz Yisrael. We're not going to have the man. We're going to have to grow our own food. That means Beitul Torah and the whole thing that goes with it. On and on and on. And it's an argument that lasts till today. So the people all panicked. They were not punished the same way the Meraglim themselves were, but they were destined to wander in the Midbar for 40 years. 1 year each corresponding to the days that they went. Of course, that's a little bit of a math problem because this was already a year and a couple of months after they came out of Mitzrayim, which means less than 39 years left to go. But they were punished for a total of 40 years, even for the year plus that came before the Chet HaMeraglim. And that's this. Then there were people who said, okay, let's go. We're wrong. We shouldn't have panicked. Let's go. And Moshe said, no, God is not with you anymore at this point. Don't go. And they went. So it compounded and compounded. And as I said, we're not even up to Korach yet, which is next week or 2 weeks for some of you. And it's just a frustrating, depressing slash frustrating, pick which either word you want or make up your own, that this is what happened. But I believe that the Torah tells us about it to say you don't have to repeat the same kind of mistakes that that generation made. And this is a message not just for our generation, but for every single generation that preceded us since then, and every generation that will continue to come after us, that we are supposed to learn. You know, I often say the concept, Ma'aseh Avot Siman L'banim, the deeds of our ancestors are a sign or a foretelling of behavior of the children. Well, that is not only absolute stuff. In other words, Abraham and Sarah were very hospitable. We're supposed to be hospitable. Good. Yaakov Avinu married two sisters. We're not allowed to marry two sisters. Yaakov Avinu got angry at Rachel for decrying that she was not becoming pregnant, and Yaakov spoke harshly to her. That's not something we're supposed to follow. So Ma'aseh Avot Siman L'banim, the way I always understand it, is emulate the good qualities, the good stories, the good character traits, and correct the ones that are not good. And that's part of Ma'aseh Avot Siman L'banim. It's not like, well, look what Yehuda did. He was mourning the passing of his wife, and he went and he slept with a prostitute who happened to have been his daughter-in-law. We're not supposed to emulate those kind of things. There is no Ma'aseh Avot Siman L'banim, but we're supposed to learn things from every single thing the Torah tells us, positive and negative. Just
Phil,
one more math thing. No offense, Susan. The concept of absolute value is, in short, plus five has an absolute value of five. Minus five has an absolute value of five. So positive lessons should be learned positively, and negative lessons, we should learn from it positive things also, by not doing it, by doing the opposite or whatever. Tirza.
yeah, when you said you're not allowed to marry two sisters, you mean while they're both alive? That's
Correct.
what, yeah, because I have a friend who married her late sister's husband.
Torah is very clear on that.
Oh, okay, so I thought.
And, you know, the business with Yaakov, they say, okay, it was in Chutz Laaretz when he married the two of them, and the Torah was not accepted as binding on the Avot. I mean, first, the question in general is, what do you mean the Avot observed the Torah when it hadn't been given yet? But even if you want to say they had an instinct or a prophecy or some kind of intuition that they should be following the Torah, supposedly that only applied in Eretz Yisrael, which is why when Yaakov came back with his family to Eretz Yisrael, Rachel Imenu died shortly thereafter, because then there was sort of more of a problem of his having two
Yes.
sisters as wives than there would have been in Chutz Laaretz. But that's just, you know, one way of looking at it. And when you're doing this, there's a lot of speculation. I was talking to one of my brothers-in-law today about Midrashim, which, if you analyze them too closely, many of them don't make any sense at all. They're just out of context and contradictory in it. But that's not Midrash. Midrash tells you something, and you learn something from it, and you don't take it apart because, you know, of a thing. I had a Rebbe once who told us something from the Gemara, and one of the kids in the class said, "But Rebbe, the Shulchan Aruch says something else." So he says, "Don't mix me up with halacha lemaisa when I'm telling you, you know, this thing," which stuck in my head as something funny, but it's not. It's there. Okay. Got much more on Wednesday, and we didn't touch the mitzvot coming up in Shlach, which we will, Emir Tzashem, then.
Thank
Regarding
you.
the man and the mizonanim,
you could maybe say, regarding the taste, that the side that you could think of that is like a blind person doesn't appreciate food because he doesn't see it. So similarly here, the man, even though you could see it, but it wasn't the pizza, it wasn't the ice cream. So you didn't appreciate that taste. And
Good,
therefore, they were
a little
complaining.
disillusioning, but good point. I would
It's
like to see
texture
them turn it
also.
into ice cream. I wonder if you could also turn it into sugar-free ice cream,
Okay,
Okay.
Scott.
Thank you.